Good morning. I'm so excited to be here today to talk to you all about the news in Stack Trace podcast. But first, we need to talk about some updates. The customer set for the latest episodes is really off the charts. I can't stress that enough. People love Stack Trace podcast. And today, we are going to make it even better. I'm Guy Rambo.
And I'm John Sandell.
How do you feel about that intro, John?
Oh, that was a good one. That was a really good one. You should have said that, and here to tell you more is John Sandell, Senior Vice President of, I don't know.
Podcasting. Oh, yeah. So that we were obviously making a reference to Apple's events, but especially because on the latest event, they spent like 20 minutes talking about stuff that's already happened, and there were no news for like 20 minutes.
Yeah, we were texting during the event, and we were both like, when is the new stuff coming? Like, when are they going to stop just, you know, talking about how good they are and actually show us some new stuff, what we're looking for, you know?
Yeah, I was jumping up and down like in front of the live blog. I thought for a little while that the live blogging people were like holding stuff because it took so long, but finally some news.
Yeah.
And nothing that we didn't already expect, I guess.
No, we were pretty spot on actually with our predictions, I think. We can call it beginner's luck since this is, you know, our first time really doing this. But yeah, they did introduce the things we were expecting to. We had some kind of wild guesses at the end of the last episode about, you know, maybe there will be some kind of a price cut on the MacBook Air or something, but those were like really wild cards. What we were expecting was the new kind of entry-level, lower-cost iPad to get the Apple Pencil support and to see the new Class Kit framework. And yeah, we saw both of those things and a couple of more things as well.
Yeah, and we'll talk all about that in a bit. But before that, we have some follow-up.
We do.
We have some follow-up about the WWDC artwork.
Yeah, that's right.
I didn't
right.
expect that.
Yeah, it was really cool, actually. We got an email from Gabriel Rupilat, who used to be a research engineer in the semiconductor industry.
Ooh.
And yeah, it's really exciting. And it turns out that if you were in this industry and you've been working with some of these techniques they use, the WWDC 2018 artwork is actually, you can actually read some things into it with a little bit of imagination also, I guess. So Gabriel says that as a research engineer working in the microelectronic mechanical systems area, I have been using a scanning electron microscope extensively to take images of the etches performed, and that one of the aspects of this industry is producing components of a ridiculously small size, like accelerometers and gyroscopes. And it's very common to take a picture that is called an isometric view of the surface being etched. And the artwork of WWDC 2018 looks exactly like such a picture. So what could this mean? Could this mean that Apple is actually working on some new custom sensors or hardware or chips that they want to show us?
Well, we'll see, but I think it's pretty like a really good picture of what that could mean. And we know that they never like put too much into the WWDC artwork, but this actually makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. We were saying on the last episode as well that, you know, with these events that they host, like the education event, it was pretty clear from the artwork that we were going to see something related to drawing, or, you know, we were guessing that we would see the Apple Pencil, which is what actually happened. And that was pretty clear, you know, in that sense. But when it comes to WWDC, usually the artwork hasn't really kind of had that kind of one-to-one mapping to what is being shown. But if Gabriel here is onto something, then, you know, it could be something like this where, you know, in retrospect, we will say, oh, right, that was this kind of isometric view. And also, it kind of seems, you know, specific enough that it could be something like this because it's not something that, you know, anyone could guess. I mean, we couldn't guess it, and a lot of people couldn't guess it. And that could be really interesting. But then again, it's something that I personally don't read too much into. I think it might just be like a pretty picture. But well, we'll see.
Maybe the WWDC artwork tips are offset in years. And this is actually a tip for like next year when they're going to introduce ARM Max.
Yeah, exactly. That would be really cool. Remember last year? We clearly told you about this.
Yeah. So thank you, Gabriel, for sending us this feedback. We loved your email and it really surprised us. We hadn't expected anything like this. And so let's move to the education event.
Let's do it.
Which I guess it is our main topic today. So 1 week ago, the 27th of March, Apple held its educational event at a school in Chicago. And like we said, they spent a lot of time talking about how great they are and how they are changing education and helping teachers and students. But we're not here to talk about that. We're here to talk about the cool technical stuff. And the first cool technical stuff that came out was the new iPad with Apple Pencil support. So what do you think about this new iPad, John? Do you think it's a good fit for people wanting to upgrade their old iPad Air?
Yeah, it could definitely be, especially if you've been kind of holding out for Apple Pencil support. This is obviously something that was previously unique to the iPad Pro. And even though the iPad Pro still has a lot of features that make it unique compared to this new iPad, especially speed, and it has the, you know, better screen, the 120 hertz refresh rate, and the True Tone display, etc. I think this is a pretty solid upgrade for the kind of low-end iPad. And it's cool to see it getting like a little bit of a speed bump, even though it doesn't run the same chip as the iPad Pro. It runs the A10 Fusion chip, which is the same as in the iPhone 7. I think it's a pretty solid upgrade, and I'm happy to see that Apple Pencil is now not only an iPad Pro feature, but it actually is something that spans across the line.
Yeah, using the same chip as the iPhone 7, I guess, worried some people because it wouldn't be as performant as possible. But when you think about it, okay, it's the same chip. It has to drive more stuff because the screen is bigger. But I guess on the iPad body, you have more thermal room, like to like make it get hotter without burning, I guess. So it's probably going to perform just as well as an iPhone 7.
Yeah, probably. It might have a higher clock speed, although I don't think anyone has any information about that. But yeah, I'm sure it'll run fine as well. The major concern, I guess, could be that it just kind of adds another device when you have to do your performance testing, especially with things like drawing, which is, you know, you have to basically render, you know, every frame, every time there's a new pencil stroke, if you will. you have to like update the thing you're drawing. And I'm sure it'll be fine, but going forward and as the iPad Pro presumably gets a speed bump or becomes better probably this fall, things could get problematic if you want to run really kind of some of the high-end drawing applications on this iPad. Maybe not this year, but going forward.
Yeah, I'm actually not worried about it, but like thinking about maybe I should get this device because I develop Chibi Studio and we are an app that's actually used in class, like not extensively, but we do have some educational customers. So we should probably worry about how the app performs on this iPad. But again, it performs very well on iPhone 7 and even the iPad mini, believe it or not. So I guess we're fine, but if you're a developer and you have an app that runs on iPad, even if it's not an educational app, you should probably think about this iPad when you work on your app.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, people were still developing these kind of drawing applications even on the iPad 1. I mean, with the first iPad where you could try to draw with your finger, and a lot of people managed to get that running smoothly as well. So I'm sure it'll be fine. It's just like something to keep in mind that you will have to kind of test your performance on this kind of lower end device as well. But yeah, I'm sure people will figure it out. Writing drawing code is always a lot of fun because you have to really get in there and optimize everything. It's not something we have to do every day as iOS developers, but when developing this kind of code that will get run on every frame, on every kind of update to the touches, that is always a lot of fun.
My performance anxiety is kicking in. Do you remember that term? We talked about in another podcast, not this one.
I do remember.
Whenever I'm writing code that's going to run several times every second, I get really anxious.
Yeah.
I think this is not going to perform. And drawing code is definitely one of those cases where you have to be very careful.
Yeah.
And you mentioned like drawing apps in the first iPad, but you always have to remember that things get more advanced and you have these like physically based drawing models today that apps use that really replicate a real pencil on real paper, and that's lots of calculations going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And now also we have the Retina screen, of course, which, you know, just means more pixels. So yeah, it's definitely not a one-to-one comparison, but yeah, I'm sure the A10 can do these kind of things. We just have to be careful when writing this kind of code in order to support this iPad going forward.
So another thing that comes to mind with this iPad is what makes an iPad a pro iPad, given that we now have Apple Pencil support on this entry-level iPad. And I guess the things that make an iPad a pro iPad are the things that pro customers really worry about and really care about, which is like the smart keyboard, the laminated display, P3 support, and more RAM.
Yeah.
I think like that's what's going to be the main differentiator for iPad Pro going forward. Unless, of course, they redesign it for WWDC or later this year and they add like Face ID and all of that cool stuff.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember now that we're comparing essentially the 2018 entry-level iPad to the 2017 iPad Pro. So hopefully we'll see a revision of the iPad Pro as well, which will probably widen the gap between this entry-level model and the Pro model.
So they also released at the event Schoolwork and the ClassKit framework. And we should start by saying that this was probably the main surprise from the event, was the rename of the ClassWork app to Schoolwork.
Yeah, big surprise.
Yeah, I actually, after that happened, I actually realized that I should actually be expecting that, because of course they weren't going to include the name of an unreleased app in a beta that's not supposed to be there. So I guess that we should be expecting that. They never release marketing names beforehand.
Yeah, they mostly use these kind of code names. Like when you found the information about Face ID, it was called Pearl, right?
Yeah, Pearl ID. That was the name. So yeah, I think we should be expecting that. And so I think the broad picture was very close to what actually happened. The broad picture we painted on the latest episode, which was that Schoolwork is like a dashboard for teachers and ClassKit is a framework for apps to provide activities that a teacher can assign to students.
Yeah, exactly. Like we talked about on the last episode, we speculated that the setup would be similar to kind of like how HealthKit can provide health data into the health app. Only the difference here is that it's a networked app where you have two kind of sides of the coin. You have the teacher's view into the app, and then you have all the students actually performing these activities in the various apps reporting back into the Schoolwork app.
Do you feel like this is becoming a pattern with iOS? Like, we've had extensions since iOS 8, I think. But these are not extensions, but they are using a framework to provide data and like integration with a first-party app, in this case, Schoolwork. Do you think this is like becoming a pattern that we're going to see more of in the future? Maybe with WWDC, they release a, I don't know, workflow kit, and apps can provide like actions for the workflow app?
Yeah, it's a really interesting architecture, and it's something Apple has been using before as well, like for example in Game Center, where, you know, the Game Center app, which is actually now dead, which is pretty interesting. We can talk about that on a future episode, you know, sing a little song for Game Center or something like that. But yeah, Game Center worked in a similar fashion where you and your game could implement Game Center, and then that would feed that back to the Game Center app where you could see all your matches and your high scores and things. And yeah, so this is similar. And I think it's a pretty nice architecture because it allows this kind of more lightweight integration, or like reporting back more than like providing UI or providing actual like features or extensions into the system. So in this case, it's like, as an app, you can basically, you know, provide an index of the kind of class activities that your app can perform. So in that sense, it works very similar to how like Spotlight indexing works, where it's actually built partly on top of the same NS User Activity API, where you can register things into Spotlight, and that allows Spotlight to find items in your app. So it's pretty similar, and I'm guessing that this is an architecture that Apple will keep using because it makes a ton of sense for the way iOS is kind of architected.
Yeah, I kind of like it. I think it's better than like using some sort of plugin interface, and it's all based around progress, right? So the app needs to provide the progress and how like far in the activity the student is.
Yeah.
Can you give us, and I think you've actually studied this more than myself, can you give us an overview of how ClassKit works from the developer's perspective?
Sure. So yeah, we've only had like a couple of hours with the actual framework. We had a little peek at the headers beforehand, but...
Yeah, you did some spelunking of your own, right?
A little bit, yeah, with your help.
Yeah, I provided John with the headers for ClassKit.
Yeah, I'm a geese spelunking apprentice right now. So yeah, but now I've had a look at the official documentation and, you know, just try the framework out a little bit. And it's based on the concept of contexts. So in your app, you have like a main context that is the root level of all the activities that that you can perform. And then you can add child context to that to kind of form this hierarchy. So if you think about all the kind of different screens you have in your app that are related to something that a student can do in class. Like, for example, if you have a textbook app, it could be like different sections in your textbook, and these could all be different contexts. So you can construct this hierarchy and feed that back into the Schoolwork app or into the ClassKit framework. And then you can provide universal links to your app. So when a teacher assigns an activity to a student, that will then use the universal link system that has been in place now for a couple of years to actually open that correct part of your app. And you can also use the NS User Activity API for this, which is, like I mentioned, the same API you would use for other things like handoff and Spotlight indexing. So that's basically what you do. You register a bunch of contexts, and this is something you do in your app. Apple recommends to do that in the app delegate, like when your app is launching. And then that integrates into ClassKit, and then you can have both students and teachers open content throughout your app.
Just an aside, of course they tell you to put it in the app delegate.
That's where you put all your code, right?
Yeah, either that or a giant view controller.
Exactly. You just need the one view controller, the one storyboard, and the one app delegate. That's it, right?
Yep, that's all you need. So nice. I kind of like it. I think it's a nice implementation. I'm going to try it out. I have some ideas for that. I entered. So for people who are listening and are developers and are interested in doing something with ClassKit, to actually get this all to work and to test things properly, you need access to schoolwork, and that's not possible for regular people. So Apple asks you to register to get access to what they call ClassKit resources. And those resources include the schoolwork app. So there's a form in the developer website. We're going to leave a link in the show notes so you can register, and they're going to send you something eventually.
Yeah. Do we think that this will be kind of the long-term solution, or is this just like a band-aid because they didn't have time to put it in the public beta release of iOS 11.4? Or do you think that like next beta, the schoolwork app will actually be pre-installed in the simulator, for example?
I don't think it's going to be pre-installed in like iOS itself, because it's not like a default app. I don't think they should like have that app in there, because it's only relevant in a school environment.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be something that you download from the App Store, and they probably didn't manage to get the, I don't know, the test flight set up for that or something. So I guess it's probably just a band-aid.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure they're going to add it to the simulator, but we'll see. Maybe they can get it to work on the simulator in time, and they're going to work on that next.
Yeah, could be something like that. So one thing that I think is pretty interesting to talk about on this topic is kind of the use cases for ClassKit, because there's a bunch of different things I think you can do with it. And I think sometimes as developers, we might not realize that actually the apps we're building are used in schools. You know, like you mentioned that your app, Shibi Studio, is actually being used in schools already. So do you think it would make sense for you to actually adopt ClassKit?
Yeah, we are actually thinking about making a specific app that is basically a version of Shibi Studio for schools, because currently all of our revenue comes from either in-app purchases or ads that are optional that the user can choose to watch to get free stuff. So that's our model, and that of course doesn't work for schools. They just like download the free app, it's free, and they use the free stuff. There's no volume purchasing program for in-app purchases. So we do have lots of educational downloads, but those are all free downloads that don't actually result in any revenue for us. So we're thinking about developing a special version of the app that's paid up front, that can be paid with the educational discount, and that will actually provide a more guided, like activity-based UI, I guess.
Yeah.
To integrate with ClassKit, because you need those like not pre-assigned but assignable activities to integrate with ClassKit, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you basically need to be able to reason about the structure of your app like a hierarchy, mm-hmm. that can all be, you know, accessible by URL or by NS user activity.
Yeah, so what we're thinking about is like using the characters for like teaching like basic stuff, basic like math lessons and like history lessons and stuff like that. That's our thing.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, because that's what they've been doing in class. Like what we've seen is that like the teachers have students make like some sort of work around like historical characters. So let's speak like Einstein, and they actually make Einstein using the app, and then they animate the little Einstein character to like talk about his own history, and that's really fun. And maybe we can like do something like that that's more guided and more based on activities.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of different use cases for this framework, but I think the challenge or the kind of determining factor for the success of this system is going to be adoption, right? Like, whether or not it will actually be worth for, you know, people like yourself to actually build a separate app, you know, invest all this time, you know, integrate with ClassKit, do all these things. Because if you are developing an app that already has this kind of structure, like a textbook, for example, adding ClassKit support might not be that hard. But for someone who sees this as an opportunity to kind of build something new, well, it's only going to be worth it if schools actually end up using this. And with Apple, with schools so far, sometimes, I mean, things are a little bit hit or miss, right? I mean, for example, the iBook textbooks that they tried to push a couple of years ago didn't really go anywhere. So what do you think about that? Like, how do you see developers approaching this from kind of like a business standpoint, if you will?
It's tricky because, first of all, you need the business justification. And I think in my case, we have that. I think we can get some success from that. But it's not the type of thing that's going to add shiny new features to your app. You know what I mean? It's not like a brand new, like, it's not like Touch ID or
right.
3D Touch that it makes sense for you to implement because it's this new shiny feature that's user-facing and people are going to love and you're going to be featured in the App Store for adopting. So it's not that kind of feature. It's a more like bureaucratic thing, I guess.
Yeah.
It's just like you provide this data and then it becomes more useful for having that data in there. So yeah, it is tricky. And I hope Apple has done the research and they actually ran the numbers and like thought about this before doing all of the work required for this. I think there are probably lots of apps in the App Store that are geared towards educational customers that already have a structure that's going to fit well with ClassKit. And that's probably what drove Apple to actually release this framework. That's what I'm hoping, of course. So we'll see. But I agree with you. Adoption is a huge issue. And I guess time will tell.
One thing that kind of strikes me about this is, you know, now we have ClassKit and we have all these kind of different ways that you can feed data into the system like we talked about earlier. But like we also mentioned, they're all kind of fundamentally based on the same thing. They're all based on like NS user activity and universal links and things like that. And one thing that got me thinking was it would be nice if Apple could, instead of kind of implementing or providing these very specific systems, like here's ClassKit, here is, you know, Spotlight, here is SiriKit, here is all these kind of things you can use to integrate, it would be cool if we could just implement one thing, like we implement NS user activity, for example, or we implement universal link support and provide some additional metadata, and that way the system could just, it could just make it work because it already has all the information. Like if Apple already had like an indexed version of our app and it knows that it's an education-based app, it could theoretically just pull that into classwork or pull that into schoolwork automatically without any extra work on the developer's part. Just kind of like how the web works, where we have all these URLs and links and each, you know, website these days, they have like a little image associated with. So if you post a tweet with a link to a website, you will get a nice image and you will get a description. It would be cool if like we had some kind of API to do that on iOS. What do you think about that?
Yeah, the one API to rule them all. I think that's been thought about many times. And yeah, I think when things are too close to each other, it really makes sense, like indexing each part of your app for like a URL-like system with hyperlinks, that makes a ton of sense. But I think each thing is specific enough that it doesn't actually work in practice. Like when you do universal links, many times the content that's related to that link is not available. You have to actually fetch it.
Yeah.
And many times when you're opening something from a universal link, you actually go through a different code path that does different stuff. Like for Groupon, the app I work on my day job, we have universal links. And like when you're browsing inside the app and you see like an offer you like, you tap it, we load the details. That's one thing, because when you're scrolling through the home screen inside the app, we already have all of the data for the offers. So we just like push a new screen with that data. But when you actually open a universal link, we most likely don't have the data for that offer. So we actually like do a model presentation, because we don't know where you're at in the app. You can be
right,
like in your like login screen inside the app, and we need to work around that. So I guess what I mean is like the individual implementations for apps are too specific to use a generic framework.
Yeah, I mean, they definitely are right now, but it would just be interesting to see steps being taken in that direction, because I feel like NS User Activity is kind of like halfway there. I mean, imagine if instead of having like UI Navigation Controller, Push Navigation Controller, which everyone is using, or Percent the Modal View Controller, imagine if it was, and I think this is kind of the way Android is working a little bit more with intents, where let's say instead of pushing a view controller or presenting a modal, you were just telling the system, open this user activity, like perform this user activity. And then you would write code like a handler or a router or something in your app that handles this activity. And if the entire navigation system was built that way, not only for, you know, this app and that app, but that was like the way to do navigation on iOS, I think something like this could actually work pretty well, because it would pretty much work exactly like on the web. So the way the code paths that you would take in your app to kind of present a new screen would be the same as if the system kind of asks you to present a certain activity.
Yeah, they could definitely have a like centralized indexing system, which they do, by the way. It's called Spotlight.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe they should leverage that for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it really makes sense. And now we lost like all of our listeners like nerding out about navigation in iOS apps.
Well, that's what people tune in for.
This was a fun topic.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Schoolwork app and the ClassKit framework, really cool stuff coming up for education. And we really hope that people actually adopt this. Apple has like their educational customers, and we're going to jump into this topic soon. And I know that if developers actually adopt this, there's going to be usage. But for the usage to happen, developers need to adopt it. So it's kind of the chicken and the egg problem.
Yeah, exactly.
So speaking of software, another thing that came out of this event was a nice update to the iWork suite.
Yeah.
So should we talk about that? I think the first thing we should mention is that we're actually using the new pages to do our show notes.
Yeah, we are. We realized that, you know, we're talking about Apple all the time, and we're writing this on Macs, and, you know, we're general Apple people. So, of course, we should use Pages. Like, why are we using Google Docs?
Yeah, that was like a realization. I guess it's justified because the collaboration features of iWork, they like nailed it, I think, with like the last update. They have been really like clunky before and didn't really work. But I've used collaboration before, and I've been using collaboration for a while, and it's working very well lately.
I think it's a little bit kind of telling that we also, our initial, like every time I'm going to share something with someone that is a document, my initial idea is always to make it a Google Doc. And I think that Google Docs has become this kind of, you know, just default solution for this kind of thing, just like Dropbox has been for a long time for sharing files with people. And it's just a good reminder that, you know, we can actually do these kind of things pretty well now with apps like Pages if you only want to share things with people in the Apple ecosystem. Even though you can use iWork online, but I'm not so sure if that's something you would like to do.
Yeah.
Compared to Google Docs.
Well, from my experience, actually, the online iWork stuff works surprisingly well. It's really remarkable what they've been able to pull off on the web, which is, as you know, is not my favorite platform, but they really nailed the interactions and it works surprisingly well. And I've used the iWork.com stuff before to share iWork stuff. I had, I think, a numbers like spreadsheet that I had to share with someone which is not an Apple user, and converting to Excel wasn't working well. So I basically asked the person, do you have an iCloud account? And the person said yes. And I said, okay, so just open up this link. And I shared with them and it worked. So it can save you if you need to share something that has to be iWork with someone who's not a Mac user.
That's really great. Because if I can use iWork, I really want to. I really like iWork, and especially like Keynote is probably my favorite Apple app. It's also because I make a lot of presentations and I do a lot of conference talks, but I just love Keynote. I think it's a great app. It's so easy to use, but it's also like it's pretty powerful, and you can make so many nice effects and animations very easily in Keynote. And the same thing with Pages. It's like Pages for me, this might be just because I've been a Mac user now for quite a long time, but Pages for me is just so much nicer to use than using like Word or Google Docs.
So you don't use DeckSet?
I do not use DeckSet.
That's what the cool people use.
I've heard. Everyone actually asks me that. It's like, why don't you use DeckSet? Like a real programmer. I like Magic Move too much. If DeckSet implements Magic Move, then I might switch.
That's really nice, actually.
Yeah.
I think the most interesting thing with this iWork update is, besides the animations that we're going to talk about in a bit, it's not in the show notes, but I'm going to bring it up. I think the most interesting part is Apple Pencil support, which like surprised me that they didn't have that.
Yeah, I haven't been using an iPad now for quite a while, and I've been kind of waiting now this year. This year, I kind of decided I want to get an iPad, but I would prefer to wait until there's like a new iPad Pro. So I'm a little bit disconnected from like what's available with the in terms of Apple Pencil. So it kind of surprised me when I saw that, like, whoa, it's not there already. I kind of just assumed that it was already supported. But it's great to see. I mean, it's for me, it's a perfect fit. It's like the slides, for example, that Apple had designed for this event. I mean, you could do, if you have the drawing skills, that is, which I don't, but if you do, then you could make something like that yourself in Keynote now, which is pretty cool. And even though I'm terrible at drawing, once I do get an iPad with the Apple Pencil, then I'll definitely use it in things like Keynote. Because one thing I love to do when I do like code samples in my slides is to have these like arrows that point like, okay, so here's what I mean when I'm talking about this, and here's an example of that. I could totally see myself like drawing that with the Apple Pencil. I think that could be quite cool.
And drawing arrows with a mouse or a trackpad is not fun.
No, it's not fun at all.
Yeah. So I had an experience with the Apple Pencil and doing a talk last week, because I presented a talk on multi-peer connectivity at CocoaHead São Paulo. And I used the iPad and the Apple Pencil to like explain how the communication works with multi-peer connectivity. So I connected my iPad to the Mac I was using to do the presentation, open up QuickTime with the video recording feature, which if you don't know, you can actually open up QuickTime and go to File, New Video Recording, and you can select your iOS device as a video device, and it's going to capture the screen.
Yeah.
Pro tip there for you. And so, and then I opened up, I think it was Procreate or something like that, and I was actually using my iPad like it was like a whiteboard, and I just like drew the two squares to represent the devices and circled stuff and drew little arrows. And then at the end, the drawing was ugly, so I opened up Chibi Studio on the side and dragged some chibis to the drawing.
Nice. That's a nice trick.
So I finally found a use for Apple Pencil.
Yeah, and it's a cool thing, and I think that, you know, it's still quite new, and I think especially in something like education, and you know, with the Logitech Crayon that was also announced, which is like the lower cost Apple Pencil kind of made by Logitech. I think this could be potentially be a quite cool thing to have in the classrooms where, you know, kids love to draw, right? And it could be a cool thing to be able to do to spice up a presentation or a report or something like that.
Yeah, and the smart annotation feature is really remarkable. I've never seen anything like it. Pages has always had like really good text flowing around objects. I remember, I think it was Steve demoing like dragging an image with an alpha channel, and the text would flow perfectly around the curves in the screen, in the image, and that was really quite remarkable. And even to this day, I think it's a great feature. And the smart annotation thing is really amazing. We have one in our show notes here. At the top there, I circled a word and made a little thing and wrote test.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, my terrible handwriting. Can you confirm to our listeners that my handwriting is terrible?
I can definitely confirm, 100%.
So I circled a word, and if you actually like select the word previous to that one and you add spaces or break the line, the little circle and text follow that word, and that's really nice.
Yeah, this is a typical, for me at least, it's a typical Apple feature. It's like, you know, most other companies would implement this just like, you know, basically you draw with the pencil, that turns into an image, and the image just is inserted into the document. But for me, it's like, oh, Apple, this is the one thing that they do really well, I think, where they're always thinking, okay, how can we take this a step further? And how can we make this nicer? And like anchoring the actual annotations to the text, I think it's this is kind of one of these like delightful features that when you see it, you're like, that's nice. That's really cool. That's also really useful. Like if you're grading reports or something, to actually be able to have that attached to the actual text.
Yeah, it's one of those little Apple things.
Yeah.
And you can think of, like, even for our use, which is show notes, maybe we want to highlight something. I am actually thinking about, I should probably have my iPads by my side here to, like strike what we've already talked about. So we remember, and or add little like hand-drawn check marks in topics. So yeah, it's really useful and well implemented. It's still beta, so they even recommend that you duplicate documents before adding smart annotations. I guess they are worried about like you completely breaking your document. So you should keep that in mind, but it's a really nice feature, and I'm glad they added that in there. And speaking of user experience, I really like that it's not like you have to go into some menu and select a different mode or something. You just tap the screen with the Apple Pencil, and that allows you to add a drawing. If you want to add a smart annotation, you just draw, basically.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's exactly how you want something like the Apple Pencil to work. You just want to be able to draw on the screen wherever you are.
Yeah, and that's like one of the best features, I guess, of the Apple Pencil stuff, that you can very easily distinguish between a finger event and a pencil event. So they can behave in completely different ways. And that allows for really cool interactions, like you use the pencil for drawing and you can use your fingers at the same time for like eraser or like for moving stuff around, zooming, and it doesn't get confused with Apple Pencil.
Smudging the color.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really cool use. So overall, yeah, I think they really nailed it.
Cool. So overall, I think it was a pretty decent event. You know, there has been some criticism about it, of course, that it was a little bit too kind of self-gratulatory, like we mentioned.
Yeah, I liked the event overall. I think you, for you to be like disappointed, you had to have great expectations, more than you should probably. I was really just expecting a new iPad and software stuff. I was a little disappointed that after the event, with the press releases, they didn't like release AirPower or something. I was expecting...
Oh, you didn't get your animation.
Nope. I was expecting them to like do a press release after and release some stuff. Unfortunately, didn't happen, so we're still waiting. And some people commented like about... Apple in education and the pricing of products, affordability, and too much self-promotion, and others like commented the opposite. So we don't want to get into that in this podcast, but I think we can direct people to the last week's ATP, Accidental Tech Podcast, where they discuss the subject in great detail. And if you want to hear the counter argument, you can read Jim Dalrymple's post on The Loop. The title is "I'm Annoyed at the Reaction to Apple's Education Event." It's a really nice title. So you can just go there and listen and read, and you'll get the opposite views, and you can make up your mind, because we don't have time to go into that.
Yeah, exactly. I think, like we mentioned on the first episode, what we want to do with this show is more like just get into the technical details and talk about how these things impact us as developers. And of course, like a lot of these things also have impact in society, especially with something like education. And there's, you know, of course, a whole different angle to it when we're talking about like, you know, education and affordability and these kind of things and what Apple could or could not do in that space. So we might dive into it in some regards on some topics, but in general, we kind of want to stick to the technical details here, mostly because that's what we know best.
And we're definitely not in a position to talk about American school politics.
No, not at all.
So on our follow-up, we talked about Apple and processors with the WWDC artwork, and just... Right before we started this recording, Bloomberg released another report talking about Apple's plans to use their own chips in Macs from 2020. So what do you think about that, John? Do you think it's feasible for Apple to move Macs to ARM processors by 2020?
Yeah, so this is something we've been hearing about from time to time now for the last couple of years that, you know, would it be possible for Apple to start using basically their own designed chips in Mac computers, just like they do on iOS or in iOS devices? So as you probably know, all the iOS devices, they're powered by the A series of chips that Apple makes themselves. So it's Apple designing their own system on a chip. And those are based on the ARM architecture, which is not what Apple use on the Mac side, where they use chips from Intel that are pretty much off the shelf. These are, of course, based on the x86 architecture. So it's a really interesting question, like, will Apple eventually want to unify these two things? Like, would they want to have, like, one chip to rule them all, if you will, or one series of chips that they use in all their different products? It seems kind of like something that will happen eventually, because Apple has gotten really, really good at designing the system on a chip. Like, the processor that is in my iPhone X is actually faster than the processor that's in my computer. And that is, you know, pretty mind-blowing. And I am personally really excited about this, and I think it could mean a whole new kind of breath of life into the Mac platform if it were to use kind of similar chips as on the iOS devices. Whether or not it's feasible for 2020, oh, that's a good question. Maybe. I think technically, yes, but then you also have to remember that we have to migrate all of the things that are currently running on x86 to this new, like hypothetical ARM stack. I don't know how easy that would be, but I'm excited.
When Steve came to the stage, I think it was 2005, he talked about macOS 10. I think it was macOS 10 at the time. Had been living a secret double life. So basically, he told the audience that from 2000, so basically from the first version of macOS 10, they have been building it for PowerPC and Intel processors. And it's not hard to imagine that they have been running builds of macOS for ARM chips since the first iPhone, or maybe before then. So I think technically, in Apple's terms, it's very feasible, even before 2020, for them to release ARM Macs. But then again, as you mentioned, there's the third-party issue and all of the supporting stuff. Like, one thing, and I think we should say that we are not experts in hardware and hardware integration. But
in case anyone got that impression.
Yeah, but if I'm correct, I think like Thunderbolt is like an Intel thing.
Yeah, that's right.
So how are they going to address that? That's like a big thing. It's not a small thing. So there's even some hardware compatibility issues in there. So we'll see. I think it's a really interesting thing. And in terms of having macOS run on Apple's chips, that's not an issue at all, because I'm sure they are already doing that.
Yeah, I don't think that's the hard part, especially since iOS and the Mac has a lot in common, like we've been discussing on the previous episodes. And, you know, the sheer fact that, you know, the iOS platform is kind of, you know, built on top of the exact same foundations as the Mac platform is.
It's very interesting because iOS came out of macOS, or should I say iPhone OS came out of macOS 10. And then the opposite kind of happened, where stuff that was made for iOS, it circled back into macOS and became macOS became iOS again, I guess, with all the back to the Mac stuff. So they modified the system for iOS and then brought a lot of stuff back to macOS. To give just one example, all of the code signing stuff, the sandbox, that came from iOS to the Mac.
Yeah.
And that's not a small thing. So both systems are very similar to each other.
Yeah, exactly. And we also have to remember that Apple has done these kind of transitions before. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we went from PowerPC-based Macs to Intel-based Macs. So this is something they have experience with, and I'm sure they could solve this in many different ways. One way would be to have some kind of like compatibility layer where it's like, if your app has not been recompiled for ARM, it can still run, but it will run in like a compatibility mode, basically in an emulation mode, which will make it slower, but it will still be usable for, or a large suite of apps will still be, you know, fairly usable that are not so reliant on this like heavy performance. So it's definitely like all the kind of, there's no like big like showstopper, I would say, at least from my perspective, just looking at this, it's like, all the parts are there, or all the things they need to do are doable. It's just the combination of them that is kind of like a big daunting task that would be like a huge thing for them to do. But I definitely think it's doable.
And like, does ARM Macs mean Macs as we know them? Couldn't this be like they are going to kill the Mac and release iOS computers as we know them, like desktops and laptops?
Yeah, that's the other chain of thought. It's like, that's the other option that you could go to. I mean, you have the same problem there, right? You have all these kind of quote-unquote, I don't want to call it legacy, let's just say existing software, you know, all the software that we all use on a daily basis that is on the Mac.
I think, John, I think we can safely say legacy by now.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I don't treat it as legacy because I'm using it every single day and I love to use the Mac, so... But in terms of the steps Apple have been taking the last couple of years, it's, you know, there are some signals that that's how they are kind of looking at this stuff, that the iOS is clearly the future of computing. And, I mean, one way would be to, yeah, let's just make laptops, like we also talked about, that actually run iOS. And I think that would be super interesting as well.
Yeah, but no, just to be clear, when I say run iOS, I don't mean like run iOS exactly like it is on iPad, for instance.
Like not a bunch of icons on the home screen that you can tap on.
Yeah, I mean like running iOS, but it has Windows, and it has Windows, I mean like the actual program Windows, not Windows, the operating system. Like having iOS, but with a shell that's geared towards usage with a mouse and a keyboard and a laptop form factor, or like a desktop form factor even. And people sometimes ask, but then what would be the advantage of moving to ARM Macs, to ARM chips, and what's the deal? The deal is ARM processors, the processors Apple makes, are really powerful, like John mentioned, and they are really powerful and perform really well with all of the power and thermal constraints of tiny, thin devices that don't have active cooling. Imagine what they could do in a Mac Pro form factor.
Yeah.
With all of the, like, the thermal capabilities and the power consumption capabilities. Imagine something that's plugged to the wall all the time, doesn't have to worry about draining a battery, with all of Apple's expertise in chips, with the A-series chips. I think that would mean really powerful computers, which at the same time are power efficient in terms of like not consuming too much power from your house, if it's a desktop. Like the current iMacs are very power efficient, but they imagine what they could do with ARM processors.
Yeah, let's not forget about the laptops. I mean, right now we get maybe maximum 10, maybe 12 hours of battery life out of a MacBook Pro. But, you know, here we could talk about like 20 hours of battery life, like basically double the battery life. And that would actually be quite tremendous. Like that would be a pretty big upgrade for almost everybody, because I mean, even if you are not the kind of person who takes your computer on long trips all the time, just like, you know, being able to just use it around the house and sit in the couch and use your computer and not have to worry about plugging it in all the time, that could be a huge benefit.
Yeah, or if there's a power outage or something, and
yeah, exactly, you can still play a game throughout the power outage.
Yeah, and if they like, if they are more thermally efficient, your laptop wouldn't burn your lap when you're using it.
Yeah, that's another big thing.
Yeah, my 15-inch MacBook Pro sometimes is not possible to use it on my lap because it actually burns. So that would be really interesting. And when we think about what Apple is doing, like, we see that they are not willing to adapt some of their stuff to the Intel world, like the Secure Enclave and Touch ID, all of that stuff. They went into the trouble of adding an ARM coprocessor to Macs that have those features, so they don't have to like make another system that works directly with Intel processors. So there are other reasons, but that's like a big one. And that kind of shows that they are more interested in investing on their own chips than investing in Intel compatibility.
Yeah, Apple is definitely focused on ARM. Like, they are even now like building their own GPUs as part of this kind of initiative as well. So in the iPhone X, the GPU is also built by Apple. So, I mean, Apple has this this desire to control things, right? And to bring them in-house and to do them, you know, do this kind of, you know, complete vertical integration. Or is it horizontal integration? Anyway, some integration and 2D integration. They want to integrate everywhere. And this is their big strength. And if they can do the same on the Mac, I mean, this would be great. And I'm sure they would love that. It's just all the practicalities. And I mean, just think about it. Like, they would have one kind of platform that they could scale to say, you know, we're putting this many kind of transistors or this amount of power into the iPhone, this amount into the iPad, because they already do that. They have the A10 and the A10X in the iPad Pro, for example. And you could kind of see that be, you know, there could be an A15Z that would run in the Mac that would be like an even more powerful version of the current generation. So I think they have already proven that they can scale this kind of architecture in a very nice way. And, you know, just taking it one step further and doing that for the Mac as well could be really, really cool.
Yeah, and imagine like the A15Z like processor running like with four of those on a Mac Pro case with active cooling, and wow, that would be a supercomputer.
Not only would customer sat be off the chart, Geekbench would also be off the chart.
It will like break the limit for an Int 64 or something.
Yeah, that'd be perfect.
So another aspect of this is impact to developers. We kind of touched this topic before, but John, as a developer, how do you feel about this? I know you're not primarily a Mac developer, but what do we think the implications would be?
So we've been talking on previous episodes about this new Marzipan framework, like the rumored Marzipan framework, and I can't help to think that, you know, if that's true, and if this rumor is true, then it has something to do with each other. Imagine a more kind of just horizontal framework that we can use on all Apple platforms that would already have to support ARM, because iOS is running ARM. So if we were to start writing code more in that fashion, more like this kind of cross-platform sense, kind of like how Windows apps work these days, where you're basically building a universal app that work on all of Microsoft's platforms and screen sizes and form factors. If that was the case, then I think that could potentially make it a lot easier for developers, and it could just make it nicer that you don't really have to care unless you're writing something extremely specific, targeting that specific GPU or that specific CPU. You could just have this Marzipan framework kind of handle it for you, theoretically.
Yeah, and in terms of like supporting both this new Mac platform and the legacy Intel platform, they already have universal binaries, which is a thing, and that's all fine. It increases binary size, but hey, it's a price to pay, and it's happened before with PowerPC to Intel. For me, like the most tricky, like the part that's like kind of not nice about this is not all Macs would immediately switch to this new processor, and of course not, because it's a transition overall, but like I don't want to have to support two completely different architectures and potentially two different UI frameworks with one app. So that's really tricky, and that's like they will need like Carbon for ARM or something, so existing apps can migrate to the new system without having to rewrite the entire app, I guess.
Yeah, I'm guessing that if this were to happen, that there would be something like that in place. I mean, they usually have a pretty nice migration strategy for developers as well. Like, you know, when there are new screen sizes on iOS, even if, you know, Apple has now been, you know, really, really telling you for years to, you know, please don't hard code device metrics in your layout code. If you don't opt into these kind of things, you still get, you know, you get letterboxed or you get like stretched out, or, you know, things usually work out anyway, even if it's not the nicest experience for the user, it still kind of works. So I would be really surprised if they didn't have something like this in mind for this thing as well, where, you know, either an emulation mode or, you know, some way of like translating, like if we're talking about a new UI framework, like some way translating that into this new framework, or, you know, having some kind of just like legacy support or like a bridge that you can use for many types of apps.
A bridge? They have a system called BridgeOS.
Ooh, interesting.
That's actually something I thought about while looking at BridgeOS, which if people don't know, it's the system that runs the Touch Bar and the iMac Pro coprocessor, which is an ARM chip. It's basically iOS, but stripped down to the basics and with special drivers for stuff. One thing I thought about is, so the way the, like, let's call it the host system communicates with the coprocessor is using XPC, which is cross-process communication. So it's very fascinating because you have a program that's running in one device, in one chip, communicating with a program in another chip using XPC, and that's fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And one of the things you can do, I'm not saying you can do this with this system, I'm not sure, I haven't looked into it, but one thing that's possible through XPC currently is you can provide another process with a surface that it can display. So you can basically render content in a process, but display the rendered content in another process. And you can like communicate events and all sorts of things. So one of the things that I thought about is maybe having like both processors, and one of them is the host, and depending on the architecture of the app, it runs in like the coprocessor, it renders its content and flushes that content over the wire to the other processor that's actually running the OS, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that sounds pretty interesting.
That's kind of like watch apps worked before, but it's very different because it's not wireless and it's, the processors involved are much more powerful. So yeah, it is interesting, and it's something that it is definitely doable. And BridgeOS has a daemon that's very interesting. It's the Apple Mobile File Integrity daemon, or AMIFID, which is responsible for sandboxing and running third-party apps. And it's present in BridgeOS for some reason, probably because the system requires it or something, but like it doesn't run third-party code. So that's something that's doable. So maybe the transition will be Macs with both Intel and ARM processors that both run third-party code, but one of them is responsible for the actual OS you interact with, and the other one is responsible for compatibility.
Yeah, that sounds super interesting and really crazy. But it's just kind of an extrapolation of what we already have with the Touch Bar.
Yeah.
So it would basically be just like switching those, like instead of having a small ARM kind of coprocessor, you would have an Intel one that is responsible for running like the old Intel apps.
Yeah, and like the T2 chip that's present in MacBook Pros with Touch Bars, that's basically an Apple Watch, so it's not very powerful. But the one on the iMac Pro, that's a full-on A10 processor. I don't know how much RAM it has. I guess it has 512 megs, so it's not a lot of RAM, but it's like a super powerful processor to be just like a coprocessor for like handling your SSD encryption and stuff.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Okay, so that's all the time we have for this week, and we have iOS 11.4 now. It's just released right before we started recording, and tvOS is out as well. WatchOS is probably coming tomorrow. We don't know yet how much new stuff is there, so we are going to keep looking and talk about them in more detail on the next episode.
Yeah, I'm sure you're going to do a lot of spelunking on the latest iOS versions to see if there's any new cool stuff in there. I'm sure we'll also return to the topic of ARM-based Macs and all these kind of things in future episodes as well. I think it's a really, really interesting topic. But for now, this is it. And if you want to find us online, you can go to @StackTracePod on Twitter, or you can go to StackTracePodcast.fm. This is where you can find the show notes for all of our episodes, and you can contact us if you want to send us some feedback or something that you would like us to bring up in follow-up. You can also find Guy on Twitter. He is @_inside, and you can find me @JohnSundell. But that's it for now, and we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye, Mr. Rambo.